Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Eggs are a good foaming agent, so if you wanted to create a meringue or a pavlova or something, you're going to have a really hard time doing that vegan. So that's a niche where the egg really shines.
But if you're just baking cookies or cakes, it's easy to swap out the eggs and convert the recipe to vegan. Our blogger Natalie Ray Good talks us through the process of making a flaxseed egg. Then Daniel Orr preheats the oven for a quick bread recipe. From Harvest Today, crowdsourced data helps farmers do their jobs better, more efficiently, and on the cheap. We'll hear what happens if the data, though, is wrong. And spring foraging is in full swing in southern Indiana. We get tips and tricks from an expert. Okay, Mark Chilla with the news. Your first story is some good food for thought during our month of baking recipes.
Exactly, Annie. We're following this story with NPR's blog, The Salt. Venezuela is in the midst of a war, a bread war. That's according to Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Amid a severe economic crisis, his government is dealing with widespread food shortages. Now, even bread is hard to find. Maduro claims that bakers are hoarding flour and using it to bake more expensive sweets rather than bread. He claims it's a plot to sabotage the country's economy and bring down the government. As a result, officials over the past month have seized numerous bakeries and arrested their owners. Meanwhile, the bakers who are still in business scramble to find the flour they need. Venezuela imports wheat to turn into flour, but due to a cash crunch, the Maduro government is bringing in only about one quarter of the wheat the country needs. That's according to the Venezuelan Breadmakers Federation. On our website, you can see a picture of a sign hanging in a Caracas bakery that reads, quote, "There's no flour, there's no bread," unquote. Meanwhile, a recent study shows the burden of obesity in Mexico is shifting from the wealthy suburban families to lower-income families. Historically, obesity was associated with higher socioeconomic status, but in the last 13 to 24 years, increase in obesity has been more pronounced among children from lower socioeconomic levels in almost all age groups. Mexico also leads the world in rates of diabetes. It's the country's number one cause of death, according to the World Health Organization. Late last year, the Mexican health minister declared diabetes and obesity to be public health emergencies. In 2014, Mexico implemented a 5 cents per liter soda tax, and new rules bar advertisements for high-calorie junk food aimed at children. And let's say you buy a bag of potato chips from the vending machine. A note on the machine indicates that you'll have to wait 25 whole seconds for it to drop. Would that encourage you to select something perhaps healthier from that machine instead? Because healthy snacks, like peanuts and popcorn, they drop instantly. That's the idea behind an experimental vending machine by Brad Appelhans, an associate professor of preventative medicine at Rush University Medical Center. He developed a device called DISC, DISC, or Delays to Influence Snack Choice, and rigged up several vending machines. He placed these special vending machines around Rush University, and over several months, he saw a roughly 5% change in the proportion of healthy snack sales. Appelhans says the effect is, quote, "not huge, but if you are to extrapolate this out across 1 million vending machines and over time, it could add up to something meaningful," unquote. Go over to eartheats.org to read more about these stories. They're collected in the next podcast post.
Great stuff. See you next time, Mark.
Thanks.
Farmers want to plant the right crops to make a profit. And to do that, they rely on data, often from the Department of Agriculture. What would happen then if that underlying data was inaccurate? As Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports, that threat is real.
Imagine you're a farmer and it's time to decide what to plant. Supply, demand, prices, outlook, you need information. Information from the USDA, University Extension Services, even economists at the Federal Reserve. And this is a place where you can find that information.
The invite to this Agricultural Economic Outlook Conference in Columbia, Missouri, said the dress code was business casual, but this crowd of maybe 150 are wearing everything from suits and ties to jeans and flannel.
I'm enjoying this barbecued pork and beef lunch here.
Row crop farmer Adam Gatson drove more than an hour to see where he should sell his corn and soybeans.
I use it for making marketing plans for the future year, trying to predict what highs are possible and when you're trying to predict where we're going to market our crops.
The room is full of farmers, bankers, and food and beverage company representatives who, like Gatson, all hedge their bets based off of these projections. Congress develops farm policy based off this information, too. Standing in the back of the room is the director of the Food and Agricultural Research Policy Institute and the man behind many of these calculations, Pat Westhoff.
We very much rely on getting good information about what production really was, what prices really are, and those sort of things are critical to our work, critical to the work of Congress, critical to the farm programs we have today.
All of this data is compiled primarily from surveys of farmers. They ask questions like, how many acres of soybeans did you plant? What prices did your bushels of wheat fetch? Who did you sell your pork to? Economists round up the responses and make the projections. But farmer Adam Gatson says the surveys can be burdensome.
It seems like they get longer and more detailed and more tedious every year. And at some point, it begins to get really frustrating about how much time it takes to fill them out.
We'd seen the percentage of producers that were responding to these surveys starting to fall over the last, I'd say, maybe 7 years or so.
Rob Johansson at the USDA says that's a problem. Sometimes response rates are as low as 60%, and that means the quality of the data could be at risk. That's Johansson's fear when it comes to acreage estimates and crop insurance payouts. The numbers also drive farm programs.
Programs that can, help with New and beginning farmers, for example, on the one hand, or on just having a better idea of what the mix is out there in terms of organic versus conventional.
The department puts this data in the public space so every farm is operating under the same information. It creates a level playing field. Take away that information, and Keith Koble, an agricultural economist at Mississippi State University, says small family farms would suffer.
Some entities that are large enough can go collect data on their own and have an advantage, for example, when they go trade in the futures market.
With all that data at stake, the Department of Agriculture is hoping to get the reticent farmers back on board with surveys. It's especially key this year as the 2017 agricultural census kicks off. It's probably the most important and comprehensive survey the department does. This time around, Koble says, researchers will likely use the internet more to reach out to farmers. And down the line, data gathering itself will change.
I think one of the things that we may see with technology, with remote sensing, with big ag data, I think the day is going to come when we're going to find ways to do some of these things differently.
The USDA is making a big push to make sure farmers not only respond to the surveys, but that they understand how important this information is. The department launched a series of videos recently featuring dozens of farm groups and universities touting the survey's significance, which may prove to be important in the upcoming months. In its initial budget, the Trump administration proposed a 21% cut to the Agriculture Department's appropriation, naming the statistics wing as a place to trim the funding. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Find more stories from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. Spring foraging is all the rage these days. Wet and warm weather has morel lovers putting on their boots and grabbing their mesh bags in the hopes of hitting it big in the woods. But then there are people like Jill Vance. Maybe you can relate.
I have never loved the taste of mushrooms, and I just don't have an eye for them either. I can step in a patch of morels and not see them.
Jill spends a lot of time in the woods looking for other goodies, most of which are easier to spot than camouflaged mushrooms. She's the interpretive naturalist at Monroe Lake. and one of the wild edibles experts on staff at Indiana's Department of Natural Resources. I met up with her this week for a foraging expedition to highlight some of the other wild foods that thrive in the spring.
We are right off of the Monroe Lake Dam, across from the Army Corps of Engineer office. So we are in the southwest portion of the lake.
I wore my heavy-duty jeans and some sneakers that I used to mow the lawn. They have mesh, so that might have been stupid. Well, but your shoes have mesh.
Mesh is fine, yeah.
Let's do it. I'll follow you.
All right, let's go.
What I did not do was spray my shoes and pants cuffs with bug spray. It's tick season after all, so Jill says that is a must. Before we get started, if you can, bring up eartheats.org as you're listening. You can see pictures of all the plants we'll be talking about and follow along with Jill. So, it's a damp day, and the woods are glowing, bright green with lots of new growth. We walk maybe 20 paces on the trail, and then we stop.
All right, this is a very common understory little shrub that you find in a lot of the woods in this area, and it's called spice bush. And if you look, we're in a little group of them here. And you can see how they kind of, the stems sort of arch over, which gives them kind of like a little umbrella-like shape to the shrub itself. And if you crush the leaf up a little bit and then smell it,
it's lemony.
Very distinctive, yes. We get a variety of descriptions for what it smells like. My favorite one is little kids will tell you it smells like Fruit Loops. Like, not like Fruit Loops in your bowl, but if you open a box of Fruit Loops and you stick your nose into the box and you get the overwhelming aroma. And it does have a very lemony, almost a citrusy kind of smell to it. But spice bush, very common. It's a nice wild edible because it's actually year-round. Primarily it's a tea plant. But you can use this time of year, the leaves are still nice and tender, and really well into the summer, the leaves are still pretty good for this. You can gather the leaves or you can gather up the little twigs, and the twigs are year-round. So if you learn to recognize this plant, you can come and gather the twigs, you know, in the middle of the winter. And you stuff it all in a little saucepan and cover it with water and boil it for a little bit. And then strain out all the leaves and stuff, and you've got a little tea right there. Spice bush tea, and sweeten the taste. And then going on to a later part of summer, the spice bush will also produce a little hard red berry. And those red berries, you can take those off, you can dry them and crush them into a powder, and it's a substitute for commercial allspice.
Now we leave the trail, which Jill says is okay in an Indiana State Recreation Area. But don't assume that's okay everywhere. She says it's important to know the rules of the place you'll be visiting. All it takes is a quick phone call to the manager of the land to make sure you're doing everything by the book. We take a few big steps over downed tree limbs, duck under some branches, brush away some cobwebs, and we come across a patch of dark green ground cover. Clover.
Not clover.
Not clover.
Good initial guess. Look at those leaves a little bit closer and tell me why they aren't clover.
Okay, well, they're heart-shaped, so clover are not heart-shaped?
Clover are not heart-shaped. No, their leaflets are just round. The three leaflets and the leaflets are heart-shaped mean that this is sorrel. And it is probably one of my favorite of the wild edibles. Now, this is probably a violet wood sorrel. Yep, there we go.
Oh my gosh, underside is beautifully purple.
Yes, it has a very pretty lilac purple flower on it as well. There's another kind of sorrel that's very common in this area that's just going to be green both sides of the leaf and has a little yellow flower on it. That one will work as a wild edible too. You can eat these. I'm going to get you to eat all kinds of new things today.
Okay, here we go.
Put those in your mouth, all right. See what you think. These are for the people who like a little bit of a sour taste to their food. And so sorrel makes an excellent little substitute for lemonade. So just gather up. You can use the flowers or the leaves. I've been eating it and drinking it for years, munching here and there. And, you know, I make a few pitchers probably a year.
After I tasted this, I knew that I'd had this as a garnish on some dishes before. A little further into the woods, and halfway down a slope, we spot a darling of spring foraging.
I was so happy to find these.
Holy moly. Is this what I think this is?
this is?
I don't know. It depends what you think it is. Is it ramps?
It is ramps.
But yeah, ramps are kind of a trend food, and that's a good thing and a bad thing. It's, you know, good because it helps people appreciate what we've got here naturally. It's a bad thing because these guys do not reproduce very quickly on their own, and a lot of the wild populations have just been decimated by the trend seekers who want to come out and get a lot of them. And I'll get one out of the ground here. Let's see. Little onion-like bulb here, and I will actually be replanting this one. I mean, it looks like there's a lot here, but there really aren't. You could imagine if somebody came out and harvested these, you know, for a restaurant, they could wipe out this entire population in one go, and that would be it. That's all we would see with ramps here. And the trendy way to prepare ramps is to use the whole plant. And they want to see the bulb and the stalk. Well, that's great, but without the bulblet there, these guys really struggle to rebuild the population. And there's no reason that you have to take the bulb. What you can do is you can come in these plants and you could just slice off the leaves. They're perfectly good. They work exactly the same way. Gives you the same flavor. And harvest responsibly. Don't take all the leaves. You know, take a portion of the leaves.
And then Jill did tuck the ramp bulb back into the ground. At the end of our day together, Jill Vance spread out 10 different books on her car's hood. She breaks them down into three categories: basic plant identification books, wild edible ID books, and then recipe books. It's important to take one or two identification books with you when you look for wild foods, because if we could make a list of rules to live by when foraging, number one would always be know your plants. And then after that,
make sure you have permission to harvest. Make sure you know what you're harvesting. Make sure you know how to harvest it and how to prepare it. And then also make sure that the area you're collecting from has not been treated with chemicals.
And just as important, harvest sustainably. A good rule of thumb, I've heard, is to pick no more than 10% of any one patch.
You know, if you enjoy these things, you should want them to return. And so you should learn how to do that, you know.
Now we'll end with one plant that we don't want to come back. We want to harvest them all and get them out of the ecosystem entirely. Wild garlic mustard greens, I'm looking at you.
And that's a highly invasive, really nasty plant. It was brought here in the 1700s as a culinary herb and has done very, very well for itself, a little too well. And it's good prepared in all kinds of different ways, and it's usually everywhere. It's my personal nemesis plant, and I can't find a single one here, so go figure.
Ain't that the way with foraging?
So you mentioned clover when we saw the sorrel earlier, so here is actually clover.
Edible things all over the place. We included even more pictures and descriptions on the Earth Eats website, and even though we didn't find any wild garlic mustard, I posted a picture so you can keep an eye out for it yourself.
This is edible.
Book recommendations are there as well. Thanks to Jill Vance of the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. Coming up, into the kitchen to bake a quick bread. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. I touched base with one of our vegan bloggers, Natalie Ray Good. Her website, The Veganette, was started as a way to encourage her friends to try some new things. If we're talking about sweets and baked goods, she says it's really not tough to convert recipes to vegan. Many of her recipes feature ingredients you probably already have in your kitchen. But there are some animal products, like eggs, that can be tricky to substitute out.
eggs are a good foaming agent. So if you wanted to create a meringue or a pavlova or something, you're going to have a really hard time doing that vegan. So that's a niche where the egg really shines, or a souffle or something.
Have you ever tried to do a vegan meringue? Is that even possible?
I have not tried. I'm sure some have, and I'm sure it is possible, because all things are possible in this day and age. But I have not done it.
What's one recipe that you can recommend to us that is foolproof? It's going to be great for a first-time vegan baker.
I would say that pancakes and waffles are a really great way to start if you're a breakfast person. The pancake recipe that I usually use, it doesn't require anything unusual outside of your pantry. It's just soy milk or almond milk and apple cider vinegar together to make a type of vegan buttermilk. Otherwise, there's nothing that you wouldn't already have, just flour, salt, baking powder, sugar, maple syrup. They're delightful. You wouldn't be able to tell any difference between a vegan pancake and a pancake made with eggs and milk. There is a fabulous soy-free bundt cake, chocolate bundt cake, that has become very popular among my family and friends, and it's a very moist, dense cake that is actually quite healthy for you. It doesn't have much oil in it. It uses applesauce as a binding agent, and it's really delicious. It's perfect, just sliced with a dusting of powdered sugar on top.
I originally spoke with her a few years ago, around the holidays. She told me that she loves Thanksgiving and Christmas because it gives her a chance to try out some new ideas. But there's one thing she always plans into her holiday menu.
I think cinnamon buns. It was kind of became a tradition in my family when I was growing up to have little cinnamon buns on Christmas morning. And I fell in love with this recipe, but it yields these big puffy yeast rolls that are stuffed with a delightful, you know, cinnamon sugary, buttery kind of center, and then a thin glaze of frosting, and they're gooey and delicious and probably the best thing you could wake up to on Christmas morning.
That gooey frosting is simple. Just confectioner's sugar, a teaspoon of vanilla, and whisk in almond milk until you hit a good consistency. Drizzle it over top of the hot cinnamon buns and it'll harden. Add some orange zest if you like. If you want to veganize family recipes like she did with these cinnamon buns, it's good to have some egg substitutes up your sleeve. She mentioned applesauce as a binding agent. You can also use bananas in place of eggs.
But one of my favorites, if you're just trying to convert a recipe, is to make a flaxseed egg. And in this process, you use 1 tablespoon of flaxseed meal, which is just ground flaxseeds. You can grind them yourself or buy it like that at the store. And then you add 3 tablespoons of hot water to that and mix it up and let it sit. It becomes kind of gelatinous and works almost exactly like an egg in recipes, and has the same water content as well, so it's not like it's going to change everything else and how much flour the recipe requires. And it's also a very healthy alternative because it's going to add fiber to your meal, and again, it doesn't have any of that bad cholesterol.
Natalie Ray Good is the Veganette. We've posted her recipe for donuts at eartheats.org. It describes the process of making a flaxseed egg, and it also features that vegan buttermilk trick with soy milk plus apple cider vinegar. Daniel Orr made a recipe for us last fall that combined baking with foraging, which is just perfect for our show today. The only thing is the foraged ingredient in this recipe is pawpaw, and that's definitely a fall treat. But he will give us some tips for identifying pawpaw trees now, early in the season. Daniel's using puree from the fruit that was freshly foraged at the time, but this stuff keeps. So, you know, if you have packets of pawpaw or persimmon puree in the freezer like I do, this recipe might be just the ticket.
They're called the Indiana banana. They have a little bit of a smell, kind of like a mango and a banana.
If you want to smell that.
Yeah.
You get that?
Yeah. And the tree has got kind of a large oval leaf, and you can kind of see them flowering in the springtime. Then you know you can go back there and get them later in the fall. They do grow in kind of muted light, so they don't have to be out in direct sun, so they can be kind of in a borderline forest area. Now, one of my cooks, Chris, loves to go out and forage, and she found these She peeled them, and then you remove the seeds, which are quite large, and then you can push the flesh through a food mill.
He's making a quick bread with the pawpaws today. Quick breads don't require kneading. You don't have to let them rise. They don't have any yeast. It's a really basic recipe.
All right, so the first thing we're going to do is we're going to butter and flour a little bread pan. You can use any shape that you want. It should be fairly small. We're going to make a fairly small loaf of bread. And you just butter the insides and then tap it around to cover all the sides. Okay, we're just going to put that excess flour in the bowl, set that aside. Okay, and then we are going to add the pawpaw puree. This is 1 cup of pawpaw puree. 3/4 cups of sugar, 4 tablespoons of unsalted butter at room temperature. And we're just going to kind of blend that together to incorporate it. So you can even put some raisins and other dried fruit or even nuts in it. A lot of people like to put walnuts and raisins in it. To this, I'm going to add 1 tablespoon of sweet seasons. That's one of my spice blends, but you could also use some pumpkin pie spice. We're going to add 3/4 teaspoon of salt and 3/4 teaspoon of baking powder. Baking powder is going to give us our leavener, which is going to make it rise and be nice and light. Okay, and then finally we're going to add the rest of the flour. Okay, just mix that till it's smooth. Old-fashioned elbow grease. All right, now you can see it's nice and smooth. It's got a nice kind of light color to it. We're going to put that into our baking pan. Okay, get any air bubbles out of it. I'm going to pop this in the oven and we'll see what it looks like.
Look at the bacon in there. We'll put this up here. 350.
Top oven to 350, everybody. All right.
Come back in about 45
minutes. All right, so we have the pawpaw bread out of the oven, and I'm going to slice some of it, and I like it toasted a little bit, and then it really kind of melts the butter.
If you've ever made banana or zucchini bread, this recipe probably sounds familiar. Want to veganize it? You can replace the 2 eggs with 2 tablespoons flaxseed meal soaked in 5 tablespoons of water for 5 minutes. Experiment a little with this till you get a good result. Okay, recipes are at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Aobon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, the Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Earth Eats executive producer is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. I'm your host and producer, Annie Corrigan. See you next time.